Today is our Sangha-wide potluck, and glad many people came today, and it's a beautiful day for us to sit outside and enjoy our mutual company. And so it made some sense, I thought, to talk about Sangha, or talk about community. And that is one of the pillars of Buddhist spirituality. It's a very important element. And what I thought of talking about is what I see as three very important elements that build community or makes community. And these three are solitude and listening and speaking. And it might seem a little bit funny to you for me to connect solitude with community or with Sangha, with the spiritual practice community. But for me, solitude is a very core and central element to Buddhist spirituality. And I would say maybe for all spirituality, I would hope. I don't know about other forms of spirituality so much. But that solitude is really one of the great jewels of human experience. And that probably very little genuine and very deep spirituality happens without some experience of solitude, some appreciation of solitude, or maybe more important, a capacity for solitude. In this wonderful jewel of solitude, it's often kind of encrusted over by alienation, isolation, loneliness, fear, and perhaps things like being overly stimulated by the crowd or by too many people, being around too many people all the time. And certainly one of the great obstacles to the wholesome appreciation of solitude are the experiences of loneliness or isolation or alienation, which is very common in our culture. And it seems almost as if the more we live on top of each other, the more we're kind of constantly bombarded with stimulus by other people, the less experienced people have a solitude, and the more there's for some people, kind of an addiction builds up, where they don't necessarily see that the constant stimulus and constant need and desire to be connected and be involved with people is the very thing that's kind of making people a little more agitated or a little bit disconnected with themselves. And that discomfort of the agitation or being overstimulated or the discomfort of being out of touch with oneself then motivates some people to reach out to even more stimulus, more contact, which just kind of perpetuates a cycle, just strengthens it. And we need to have some way to step out of the so-called addictive cycles of constantly wanting more and more in order to appease our discomfort, to find out we have to step outside of the system entirely, and rather than constantly try to more and socialize more and more and more. And I think many of you will find that when you do meditation, that the mind has tremendous momentum, and that if you try to appease the mind or try to satisfy the mind's desires or the mind's aversions within the game the mind is playing itself, there's no end to it. It'll just keep kind of wanting more and more, keep putting up more and more resistance to things. And that part of the power of meditation is to help us kind of step outside of the game, outside of the regular patterns that we're caught up in. And am I stepping outside, allowing the mind to settle or to calm or to relax in some deeper way? So I think our tremendous momentum to socializing for some people gets in the way of very deep connection with themselves and paradoxically often very deep connection with other people. I've talked to a number of people in the context of meditation retreats where people's sensitivity of what propels them and what motivates them and what hurts them is usually quite strong. I've talked to people who maybe feel either very judgmental of other people or feel very isolated or alone, or often both. And as we begin probing and exploring, inquiring into what's really going on for people, that the alienation that some people will feel to the people of the world around them or the way they're judgmental towards other people often is symptomatic of something much more deeper and more important, is the alienation they have towards themselves. And many times I've heard people say things like, you know, I don't really have a lot of friends out there. I don't really feel like people know me very well. I don't really feel like I know other people very well. And you get to the heart of it, and it seems like what's really going on is they don't know themselves. And they're unwilling to kind of go into themselves because of some, you know, sometimes it's difficult to do that. And if we don't know ourselves really well, or we don't have the capacity of touching ourselves deeply, then it's very hard for other people to get to know us. And so that kind of, if other people can't get to know us, then we feel even more alienated, more uncomfortable, and then maybe we shut down even more. But there needs to be some turning back that steps outside of that system and turns back and helps these kinds of people really get to know themselves well first, and then they can connect better with other people. So the same way, I think solitude provides a very deep familiarity, hopefully, of ourselves with ourselves. And that familiarity helps us then connect more honestly and completely with other people. Solitude also provides a wonderful solitude provides an opportunity for us to find out who we are and for some of the momentum of our life to begin to unwind. And if we don't have the experience of solitude, it's often very hard to let the constant momentum of desire and aversion or wanting and coping and dealing with things, to let that momentum kind of subside, to see kind of deeper currents of our life underneath the kind of surface chatter of what is constantly going on. And certainly a daily sitting practice provides some of that solitude. And for some people, it's quite profound. It may be enough to kind of create the balance. But aside from any value that solitude has in what it provides us with, kind of beyond itself, it's been my experience that solitude is wonderful in and of itself. And that I don't need to kind of explore or want to find solitude because it helps me connect better with other people or because it helps kind of reduce the neurotic momentums of our lives. But rather, just simply being alone sometime, having the ability to be solitary, is really, a fantastically beautiful thing to do. And it's some of my greatest joys in life have come in periods of solitude. But in terms of sangham building or community building, I think that solitude, the ability to be solitary, the ability to feel comfortable with one's own solitude, makes it a lot easier to enter into community without neediness, without kind of getting it complicated. If we're able to kind of be comfortable with ourselves, be at home with ourselves, which is almost the same thing as the ability to be solitary, then we can encounter other people and not have that encounter being filtered through our needs, our desires, our fears, our inhibitions, but we can just simply meet the other people as, you know, as we are. We can just be ourselves in a sense without any extra agendas going on. So I think solitude, the ability to be solitary, I think is very important to build community. Many of us don't have that ability. You don't have that ability that often. And so a sangha is not necessarily a place where you're supposed to be ideally, but rather a place where you begin to explore the interface between, for example, our search for solitude and our search for being together with others in a healthy way. Our search for being independent or being free and our search for being connected and involved. So it's often a wonderful playground or workshop or sometimes feels like a battleground, a sangha life, living a community, because we're not ideal, none of us are ideal, and so because we're not ideal, we have to kind of brush against each other, and our hard edges kind of brush against each other, and that brushing against each other and meeting each other and finding out about how actually we work and is a wonderful thing that happens in sangha life. Community life, maybe it happens anyway, all the time, but the difference is in a sangha, in a spiritual practice community, it's allowed to have friction, or friction is held within the container. It's understood that none of us come here as being ideal beings, and because of that, there are going to be kind of awkwardnesses as we encounter each other, and meet and talk and do whatever we want to do together, And that awkwardness is included and welcomed, in a sense, as part of the mirroring and part of the help, where we kind of begin to find out what's really going on. And so rather than turning away from the awkwardness because it's uncomfortable, or rather than judging it because it's, you know, this implies that the other people are wrong or I'm wrong or whatever, rather it becomes, you know, the field of what we practice with. So solitude. The other important element of community building is the capacity to listen. And maybe this expresses my bias, but I believe that, you know, I'm kind of going through the order of importance: solitude, listening, and then speaking, in terms of building community. Because many people maybe operate under the idea that's the opposite way around. And first, it's very important that everyone listen to me. And then maybe I'll listen to them. And then maybe eventually I can feel some solitude. So the idea that listening is important, to be able to listen to each other, find out what's going on with other people, to listen very deeply. There's this wonderful saying I've heard from somewhere that God gave us two ears and one mouth so we can listen twice as much as we speak. But to listen deeply. Listening involves partly a loss of control. And maybe that's why some people don't want to listen. Because when you're listening to someone else, you have to give up some control. You have to be kind of willing to kind of find out what's going on there. It's unknown. They're going to speak for a while, and you don't know what they're going to say. So some lack of control. And control manifests itself often as rushing in to state our opinions, or to interrupt, or to criticize, or... Sometimes control takes the form of spacing out. I'm not going to listen to this. But to give up control. And giving up control is a very important element of, I think, at least Buddhist spirituality, or at least knowing what areas of our life we can have some control, where it's important to bring our attention and our choice, and what part of our life where we don't bring our choice, but rather, in a sense, let go or surrender into a loss of control, lack of control. There's a kind of an idea which maybe isn't so well formed, but that I like, is that if you're not comfortable with the mystery, then you can't become the mystery. And the question is, do you want to become it, or you want to keep yourself removed? And I got this little kind of idea from a Zen friend of mine, who, when he does funeral ceremonies for people, he says something like, in Zen, in funeral ceremonies, you often speak to the person who's died. And he says to the person who's died, now you've become the mystery, having died. So there's something about the mystery of life, the unknown, or maybe some people don't like the word mystery, but some element of giving up control, of entering into some other sphere of momentum, the other sphere of life, that doesn't necessarily involve our constant manipulation and control and judgment, and even our understanding of what it is. Understanding is one of the great hindrances to liberation. If you always need to understand, then that'll keep you back from the experience of liberation. Liberation is never going to be what you think it is. So if you're struggling to understand it, then that'll hold you back. So listening involves partly a lack of control. Listening involves being really present for someone and being willing to suspend as much as we can our inner judgments, our inner voices, our inner interruptions of what people are saying, but to listen very deeply to what's going on. And not just listen to the words, but also to listen to what's behind the words. The feelings, the emotions, the history of the person, the struggles of the person, the joys of the person. The intentions of what's being said. And the intentions are often not, sometimes not what's stated overtly of the things that are going on. A story I've told a couple of times recently is my friend of mine who had a parking lot alteration with someone, I guess over a parking space. And he was a little bit, I think, mindless. So he somehow ended up taking someone else's space or blocking someone. And as soon as he realized that he you know, what the problem was, he kind of tried to correct it, but the person was quite furious at him and was yelling. And so my friend kind of apologized and I guess pulled out of the way or did something appropriate. And then said to the person, hopefully, I imagine, with great appropriate compassion, said something like, you're having a hard day, aren't you? And as soon as he said that, the fellow relaxed. He said, yeah, today's been a difficult day. So there was an example of he was listening to something else besides the anger, the hostility. But he was listening to what was behind it, and he assumed kind of what made sense was that he was having a hard day, and his frustration level was what was feeding his hostility. One of the great practices is around listening, is to listen out hostility, hear out hostility. Hopefully, all of you have had that opportunity. If you haven't, look for it. It's a great thing. Listen to hear out someone's hostility. Because most of us, when someone is hostile, we get hostile back or defensive or we run away. But actually, if it's a safe situation, to hear out the hostility. Just hear what the person has to say and ask questions. Invite them to keep saying, why are they so hostile towards you or what's happening? And sometimes you'll find that if you hear it out, it'll dispel the hostility. Because hostility often, if it's very strong, filled with hate and venom, it often has very little to do with the object of the hostility, but a lot to do with what's going on inside of the person who's hostile. So if you listen and you hear out the hostility, you can often get a chance for that inner tension to begin to unravel, to show itself and to relax. So to listen deeply, to find out what's going on with other people. Even when people come with great kindness and great expressions of care or expressions of sharing themselves in a very, very deep way. Very important part of Sangha life is taking the time to listen to each other, to hear each other, find out what's going on with each other. And listening, in a sense, is very closely connected to the practice of mindfulness itself. It's a form of mindfulness. Rather than simply being mindful to your own thoughts and feelings and body sensations, it now is being mindful of someone else and listening very deeply to someone, hearing, sensing, and feeling. I was at a Spirit Rock teachers meeting this last week, and we decided we had to listen to each other better. So what we instituted, each time we have a meeting, we take 20 minutes of the day-long meetings, and we sit and we just have these little dyads. And we sit and we just kind of talk with each other as teachers about our personal relationship to each other. So over the months and years, you kind of go through there's 17 people on the Spirit Rock Teachers Council. So we have meetings about four times a year. So I guess about every 4 or 5 years or so, you cycle through. And it's actually been very wonderful for the Teaching Council because it's really helped us to create community because now we know each other a lot better than we did before. And anyway, we were going to do these dyads last week and just talk with each other and about each other and how we see each other and give constructive feedback and various kinds. And about our teachings and how we are as teachers and from other teachers, imagine that. So one of the teachers interrupted, before we were going to start, he interrupted and gave us a little Dharma talk, a little lecture about how we should listen to each other. And it felt a little bit odd, you know, in that context, you know. When teachers get together, you stop being a teacher. But anyway, you know, it was nice. The sentiments were nice. And I think that the intention was good. But what he said was interesting. He said, I never heard this idea, was he said, when you're listening to each other, he said, don't listen so much. Just stay 100% in your body. Just stay in your body sensations. Stay what's going on in your body. And he felt great confidence that if you just stay with your body sensations, listening would happen anyway. You would hear. But if you stayed in your body, you would be hearing what was going on, but you'd also be tracking what your reactions and feelings were. And if you started kind of being carried away, that you'd notice that really quickly, and it would actually be easier to stay present for the listening. So I have some doubts about this, at least for me, because if I put my attention 100% someplace, I tend to kind of shut off the other sense doors. So when I listen, I try to do both. I kind of go back and forth, or I'm tracking many different areas. I'm trying to listen very carefully. I'm tracking my feelings, my body, my sensations, my reactions, my thoughts. And I'm tracking all of these, because if I'm 100% with listening, then I'm not really 100% with listening. It means that my conscious attention is with listening, and my unconscious, my inner life might be doing something very different, carrying me away or judging or reacting. But if I do both, if I stay very careful, attentive to who I'm listening to, and at the same time try to be very attentive to what is going on inside of me, then I feel like we can have very good listening and very good communication. That also means that I tend to track much more carefully why I want to say something when I'm going to say something in a conversation. Because I know that if I'm not doing that careful tracking, listening carefully, and also tracking carefully my reactions inside of me, then I can say things rather impulsively. And sometimes I'm sorry I've said them. Sometimes I rely often on intuition for what I'm going to say in conversation. But it's an intuition that is not spontaneous. It's an intuition where I'm very attentive to the wider inner ecology of reactions and thoughts and judgments and fears and body sensations that are going on. And because I'm aware of those things, then I feel like I can track my intuition more carefully and know when an intuitive hunch or intuitive statement is appropriate and when it's not. Because one of the things I've learned is my intuition is not always right. So I don't want to say, intuition, is this all great, it's all great and, gives me access to wonderful sources of wisdom. Intuition doesn't always do that. But the careful tracking that I do often helps me discern when it is and when it isn't. And a lot of it has to do with paying attention to my intention. What's the intention for saying this? Why do I want to say this? So speaking is the last of the three community building factors I'm talking about today. And speaking helps create community, builds community. But speaking also can tear apart community, can ruin friendships and relationships. Probably all of you know the kind of the saying that goes, it can take 20 years to create a very good friend, but a minute to spoil it with what you say. Speech is very powerful, and because of its power, I think it's very helpful to listen, to learn, to have real great skills of listening before we rush into our speech. But how is it that speech creates community? It creates community, I think, when we share ourselves honestly. When we have the ability to know what's going on with us and to share ourselves honestly, this is how I feel, this is what's going on with me. And rather than expressing in our speech our judgments or our gossip or our criticism or our cynicism, I think cynicism and gossip and sarcasm all, in a sense, tend to make community more difficult. But if we can somehow track our speech and notice what kind of speech we make tends to sever community and what helps create healthy community, I think that's very important for creating healthy community. And one of the things to pay attention to is it really creating community or feeling of closeness or connectedness with the immediate person you're talking to? Or is it also helping to do that with a wider community? And why I say this is that sometimes gossip or sarcasm or cynicism can be shared between two people and can bring a lot of energy. If you could sit down and say, hey, let me tell you what the other person did. Let me tell you what so-and-so did. The other person, oh yeah, I want to hear about that. And then you tell them, they go, wow, how could they have done that? And suddenly there's kind of feeling of camaraderie and kind of, you know, you're in it together, you really know. And there can be a lot of energy and a lot of aliveness in two people who are sharing gossip until you find out that they're gossiping about you too, some other time. And so you want to be very careful that the sense of connectedness that you're creating is a healthy one. And one of the ways is to kind of track and see, well, is this really helping to create concord in a wider community? And gossip and cynicism and sarcasm often create, in the wider community, tends not to create harmony, but rather to work against it. So in relationship to speech, it's very important to track the intention behind our speech. Why are we saying what we do? And I've noticed that many times I'm not aware of the intention before I speak, but I try to do that. And I think that's one of the great ways in which mindfulness has helped me in my life, is by helping me pay attention to why I say what I want to say. And there's often many agendas going on. It isn't just simply that I'm giving some piece of information that's very important for the other person to know. You know, it's very seldom that we're just, you know, exchanging information. We often want something in a relationship. We're trying to create something in a relationship. We're sharing intimacy in the relationship. Sometimes the intention is, I'm going to tell you this because I want you to see me in a certain way. So I'm going to say it in a certain way because I want to be seen. I want you to recognize this is who I am. So we say something in that way. I remember once, some years ago, I've told this story before. I saw someone who I hadn't seen for a long time, just before our Monday night sitting group, before I was going into the friend's meeting house there. And we were having a wonderful kind of little exchange. And then it was time to go in and to sit and for me to give a talk. And I said, last thing I said before I went to sit in silence was, I just gave this person this very important piece of information that the person, of course, needed to know. And that was, I hadn't prepared the talk tonight. You know, major news, right? And so I sat down, kind of resonating in my ear, in my mind. I had just said that. I sat down to sit. And because I was sat down in silence to sit, I immediately noticed, you know, why I said that. Unfortunately, I noticed after the fact rather than before. And after the fact, I realized why I said that was I hadn't, in fact, prepared. And I was a little bit nervous about this friend of mine hearing me make a fool of myself. So if I could give them this little piece of information, I was preparing them, kind of trying to predispose them so that they would not judge me negatively for making a fool of myself because I hadn't prepared. So we often, I think, at least maybe I should say me sometimes, there's other intentions, agendas going on in why we say something besides the overt message we're trying to pass across. And so to start paying attention to that intention in us, why are we saying what we're going to say? I would venture to guess that it would be transformative for most of you here if the only mindfulness practice you did was mindfulness of why you're going to say what you're going to say before you said it. If you tracked throughout the day for 1 week the reason why you're going to say something before each time you're going to say it, I think it would be transformative. So solitude, learning to appreciate it, learning to take refuge in it, learning to settle back in it, in the middle of a conversation, to be comfortable maybe without saying anything for a while. Are you comfortable with silences in your conversation? If you're comfortable with solitude, maybe you will. And to train yourself, to dispose yourself, to be a better listener than a speaker, to listen carefully. And then to speak mindfully with intention and speak in such a way that is conducive to concord, not only with the person you speak, but with the wider community you live in. So it's a great thing that we have this Sangha here in the peninsula. I am very grateful for this community And it's been rather awing for me, personally, to see it grow in the many ways it's growing. I remember when it was when I first started, there were 12, 15 people who came once a week, Monday nights. And that was 10 years ago. And slowly it's grown and grown and grown. And now we have a lot of different activities. Some people just come to one activity, which is fine. But we have a lot of different things going on. And one of the real strengths that's happening here is that we're developing a very strong sangha, a very strong community. And the I think it's really necessary for that to happen in many ways, because it actually gives a greater range of opportunities for people to develop their practice. The more the community does, the more activities there are, the more areas of our life we can somehow address as areas of mindfulness, of practice. It lets us develop our spiritual life in different areas of our life. So having a sutta study class, for example, gives people an opportunity to explore that more intellectual side of the practice, perhaps. To have potlucks gives people a chance to socialize more and develop more of that side of their life. So as we do more, there's more and more opportunities for a kind of wider and a fuller spiritual life. But as we develop more and more as a community, I think it's very important to remember the value of solitude, because there's a tendency for many people to, because we're social beings, that as a community becomes more and more a community with more social activities going on, it's easy to let the balance of where the one's involvement with the community go from a dedication to the practice to it becoming mostly a social club. And not that that's bad, and some people, that's what they need for a while, is to, but part of the function of my function is to try to ensure that we have a balance of a very strong grounding in the practice itself and a supportive community for that practice. So as long as we stress the value of solitude, then we can, I think, become as strong a community as we want. And I hope we do, because I have a great appreciation for this community. And as I just said, I'm kind of in awe of what we've become, and very, very appreciative. And so I express my great gratitude to all of you. And now I guess we can all share in that gratitude by feasting together, having a potluck. So all of you who want to stay for the potluck, I look forward to seeing you there. And for the rest of you, have a wonderful week. Thank you. And maybe, excuse me for saying this, but I realize that many people came today who don't usually come to our Sunday gathering. So you're kind of, in a sense, new here to Sunday, and maybe you don't know a lot of the people here. And maybe before we break, there's 5 minutes before we formally supposed to end the talk. Could you each turn to two other people near you and just say hello and introduce yourself, just so that everyone kind of feels that they've been you know, know someone here, maybe new, and help break, break the ice.